Hi, and welcome to episode 8 of the Sled Dog Podcast, interview with Greg Salentin from Mushing Magazine. Hi, and welcome to the Sled Dog Podcast. This is Tim.
And this is Gina. And this is the podcast that transfers, transforms, and transports you on the sport of dog sledding.
Transfers, transforms, and transports? I don't get it. What do you mean?
Don't you understand what the word trans means, dear?
No.
Well, our interview today is about a gentleman that has transferred. He's transformed his life, and he has transported everything that he owns.
Yes, that's right.
From New Jersey all the way to Alaska.
Yeah, this is an interview that I've been trying to work on for quite a few months. I'm so excited. Greg Salentin from Mushing Magazine, just a great guy, but more importantly, just his story of how he's come to what he's been doing and how Mushing Magazine is transforming into what it is, and more importantly, just the whole dedication that Greg has towards it, you know, to not only leave his career in New York City, to move up north into Alaska just so that he could be closer to the dogs, the sport, and obviously the magazine. So the interview today is all about Greg and about how he is not only, I guess, what, moved? Just his story and his passion behind Mushing Magazine, which, you know, to me, that was, I don't know how to describe it, but when we first got into dog sledding, and I've heard so many stories since we got started, is as soon as somebody says, hey, you're thinking about dog sledding, somebody notoriously will hand that person a stack of Mushing Magazines.
Right.
It's kind of like, oh, well, you need to learn this, but more importantly, here you go. And the Mushing Magazines, I think, give us the inspiration to really, you know, carry on. You open it up and you realize, gosh, this isn't just, you know, four people in the middle of nowhere doing dog sledding. There's a huge sport and a huge culture that's around dog sledding, and it's just a fantastic way to get embraced with that and realize you're not the only, you know, only one thinking about those same things.
And each of those magazines, you know, we keep them because they're almost like a piece of literature, a book that you can pass on to everybody else that's in the sport or reread it or, hey, wasn't there an article about that in Mushing Magazine? So we have our own little stack, too, and we've given our magazines away as well, so.
Yeah, no, what are we giving them away for? I don't know about it. No, it's
so
important.
Dear.
I know, we'll get them back. But it's like to Gina's point, it is amazing because those magazines, you know, just like anything, you'll read something and you go, okay, that, you know, that I'm not really there yet. And then a couple months later, a couple years later, you go back to that magazine and say, didn't that article talk about exactly what I need? And at the time that you read it or the time you saw it, it may not have been that important to you. But then a couple months later, or it got you thinking about it, and suddenly you're like, yeah, maybe I do need to do it that way. And just kind of opens your mind up and your eyes up to what's going on. So it's kind of neat.
Yeah.
Plus all the, you know, I think it's a great way that I have found all the distributors of equipment and the dog food and the sleds and,
sure,
you know, just keeping involved with the advertising that he has in the magazine kind of keeps you abreast of what's going on, too. So I think that's part of it, too.
Before we begin today, Tim, I wanted to make mention that Nancy from Oregon left us an email.
Yes.
And was really excited. She's a older person, so she puts it. An empty nester
you,
who's
Nancy.
Started running with her Malamutes. And so we just want to say, hey, Nancy, thanks for contacting us and sharing your thoughts about our podcast. We surely appreciate it.
Tell your husband, just keep pushing through. He'll enjoy it someday. So he will, he'll get into it. So
yeah.
Thank you, Nancy.
That was great. And also to Lori from Swartz Creek. She's actually in our Mush Club, but left us an email because she listened to a couple of our episodes, and she did have a question. She wanted to know,
yes,
who was the voice of Shoni?
Yes, and we have Shoni here in the office today, so Shoni came to visit with us.
Hi, Shoni. How are you doing? Well, hello there. I'm so glad to be with you all today. Thanks for inviting me, Master.
Yes, Shoni is a beautiful Alaskan, and she is just, this is the first year that we haven't run her, and yesterday as we did our training, you know, I just see these big eyes looking at me, and she is, I don't know. I don't know if we're going to be able to not
well,
not
no,
run her that
we're going to take her on some runs. She just needs to be a little shorter.
Yeah,
and
not so fast.
Not so many dogs.
Not so many dogs,
Not
exactly.
An eight-dog team.
So, Shoni, we love you very much, so thank you for coming to the studio. Go lay down and eat your bone.
Oh, thank you, Master.
Nice. Thanks. Well, wonderful. Well, thank you so much, everybody. We're getting great feedback from folks. And more importantly, we've got quite a few numbers of people listening. It's just neat to see. About half the group is listening right off the website, and the other half is downloading with their with iTunes, which is the pod-catching software. So if you do not like to just have to go to the website each time, you can actually go and use iTunes, which is a free software by Apple. You can download it and then subscribe to it, to our podcast. Just up on the upper left-hand side of our page, there's a button that says iTunes. You just click on that, and it will automatically subscribe you to our podcast in iTunes. So it's kind of neat.
When they do that and we put a new episode up, does iTunes let them know that there's an episode like this one that we're just about to put up?
Yeah, it does. As a matter of fact, it actually automatically downloads directly to their computers. So they don't have to do anything. They just launch iTunes once a day, once every couple of days, or whatever they want to. And iTunes will reach out there and find the new episodes and just bring it right down to the computer.
Great. Great. I know all this technology can be confusing, and actually when we talk about podcasting, generally we get a big blank stare.
Yeah.
But when we explain that it's a simple audio interview, it somewhat comes around. So
yes, and I want to thank everybody. I think the biggest way that we're getting new subscribers, and it's just, you know, it's so funny, is we're not doing this for the numbers game, but it is makes you feel good to know that people are listening. The biggest way that we're getting subscribers are people telling their friends or telling their clubs. So if you happen to get a chance to just kind of mention it to folks, we'd greatly appreciate it to keep our numbers up there. And someday, I don't know if that'll matter or not, but it just makes you feel good knowing that you're doing something that more people are listening to.
Well, also what will help, too, is if you get the word out there, if anybody's ordering from Amazon for Christmas, all you need to do is just go through our link. There's nothing that you lose by doing it other than a few seconds and a few clicks. So if you could please order from Amazon through our link, that'd be great. That would benefit our podcast as well.
Doesn't cost them any more. Doesn't cost you any more. Just we get about 0.5% or something like that. So it's kind of nice. The bandwidth costs and the cost of the site kind of cost us some money. So we just help to offset that. But other than that, we're going to just keep doing this because we love these interviews. And
oh, Tim, don't forget, we have an interview following Greg Sullenton again with Dr. Tim, his vet tips.
Yeah, it's going to be another great vet tip. So thank you again, Dr. Tim. And we'll probably jump right into that interview right after Greg's.
Great. Well, let's get to it.
Okay. Hey, well, welcome. We have Greg Sullenton from Mushing Magazine with us today. And Greg, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Tim. Just wanted to say hello and appreciate you giving me a call for this interview.
Well, Greg, this is a huge opportunity for us. We have been reading Mushing since we got into dog sledding. I think everybody does. And it's just one of those very exciting things to be able to talk to yourself and also to find out more about you and find out, I guess, a little bit about the backside of Mushing and how you got into this and why you do what you do. So I guess to start us off, is tell us a little bit about Greg and Jane, your wife.
Well, the way I got into Mushing was in the middle, probably the mid-80s, or middle to late 80s. I think it was 86, 87, somewhere around there. My wife and I had just recently graduated from FIT, which is kind of a fashion and an art school in Manhattan in New York City. And both of us had kind of set up our lives, and our dreams were always to work in, you know, fashion, advertising, photography, world in New York, and never thought we'd want to move out of the city. We were very much in love with the urban lifestyle and, you know, and all that it held. We met in college in 85 and started dating, and then once we got out, I guess it was 89 when we got our first dog. We were living in an apartment in Midtown Manhattan, and it was a small apartment. It was actually a studio apartment, didn't even have a separate bedroom. And I had wanted a dog, you know, because you're done with college, you got your job now. I was working as an apprentice to a photographer, and, you know, I just felt kind of settled. And I'd always loved dogs. I've always had pets as a kid growing up. But so I wanted an Akita because that was the trendy dog to have, you know, in New York at the time. And my wife was afraid of all dogs, but she had returned from home from Boston where her friend had a Husky mix. And she said, we were having breakfast in the diner one morning, said, you know, well, maybe we can get a Husky. Kim's Husky is really nice.
Nice.
And I'm not afraid of that dog. So I marched her right down to the pet store. And we, I figured if, you know, if I didn't act then, she'd change her mind. So we got a typical black and white masked, blue-eyed Siberian Husky. And What started me, the interest in the sport, I had no idea, you know, that this was a modern-day sport. I had known, you know, the stories of Jack London and followed the Iditarod loosely through the... At that time, they used to print the Iditarod map in the New York Times sports section every day and give you updates, albeit they were a couple of days late, but
wow.
it was before the internet. It was a way to follow. And I was always a big fan of any kind of adventure sports, especially those kind of things like the Tour de France and the Baja races and the Paris-Dakar car and motorcycle races, and the Iditarod kind of fell into that. So I loosely knew about it, but I didn't know it was a modern-day sport you could do anywhere. But they hand you this book that tells you the heritage of the breed of the dog you just bought, you know, whether it's a Pekingese or whether it's a Siberian Husky, and ours was a Siberian Husky. And I kind of get into things like 100%, probably more than 100%. I throw myself into pretty much all of my hobbies and work and everything. And I just, you know, there were a couple of references in the back of the book, and I noticed those names were from New Jersey. I looked them up, got their numbers, called them, and they said, well, we do this rig racing on carts down in New Jersey Pine Barrens in the weekends in the fall and the winter. So I ended up going down, you know, putting the dog in a Jeep, my Jeep, and driving down there and checking it out. And then, you know, like with everyone else, it just snowballed from there. We had two dogs living in Manhattan, then we had three dogs living in Manhattan. We had to move out just across the Hudson River to Jersey City, and we bought a brownstone and paved the backyard of that and had up to 8 or 9 dogs there. And I was pretty serious while living in that very urban environment. I had a dog truck that would park in the local garage, and when it came time to after work to train, I'd get home about 7 o'clock, and I'd pull up the dog truck in front of the brownstone. We owned the whole building, and, of course, the whole block is attached, buildings. And I rented out the top 2 floors to a tenant, and I had the bottom 2 floors plus a basement. But to get the dogs from the backyard kennel out to the street, I had to run them through the apartment. So we'd bring them through the apartment. The truck would be double parked. People would be honking. I'd load up the dog truck, and I had a fold-up rig that attached to the back of it. And I would drive about an hour, 20 minutes out to an area of New Jersey that had a rail-to-trail, an old railroad bed that converted to a hiking trail. And I would train my dogs in the dark. I got pretty good. You know, I think I was probably the most successful urban musher, or maybe the only urban musher. But,
now, what year was
I got? That was all the way from 1992, actually probably 1990 when we lived in New Jersey, to 1998. And I did well. I raced mainly, I started out in that kart circuit in lower New Jersey, and I won a couple of those. But then I discovered the snow racing, and I ended up racing a lot with the New England Sled Dog Club. The Alpo races were just at the tail end of their heyday, so I did a couple of those, and also the Down East Sled Dog Club and the Pennsylvania Sled Dog Club. And all of those races that those three clubs put on were anywhere from 6 to 12 hours drive away. So I would usually, I would try to train the dogs as much as I could in New Jersey, and then come Friday night, I'd get home from work. Maybe I'd be able to take the day off or get off early, but do all my driving Friday and get there, you know, in the wee hours of the morning and race on the weekend. And it was really a neat thing to do, and I kind of miss those days because, you know, you're kind of starry-eyed about the whole sport and when you're just getting into it. And the contrast was incredible for me. I'd be Friday, you know, if I was working on Friday, I'd be in a cab in Midtown Manhattan going to an ad agency with an arm full of photographers' portfolios trying to sell their work. A very stressful thing, every visit, every sales pitch was a pretty big dollar thing. So I took it pretty seriously. And then, you know, 18 or 24 hours later, I was in the Adirondacks on a dog sled, you know, going down this beautiful lake trail underneath these pines full of snow. And every once in a while, it would just hit me how I kind of had a double life. And I didn't let a lot of people in the city know about the dog sled hobby because I just didn't want to get into having to explain it all the time. Yeah. You know, I did a couple of times, and I just, gosh, this takes, it's so alien to everyone in that environment. You had to just really explain it, and it took away a lot from the points I was trying to make business wise, but then again, you know, after a while, I did get kind of known as having that hobby.
So, you know, you did that. You're working in Manhattan still, living in Jersey, And you did that for a while, and then you started your first magazine.
Yeah, there's kind of a segue in there. In 1998, we moved out about an hour and a half out into New Jersey to the area where I used to drive out and train. So my wife and I ended up trying to commute back and forth to Manhattan. And my wife did it for about a year, and it became too much because it was a two-hour commute each way. And I did it until shortly after 9/11. Actually, I did it a few years up until about 2003. I did it, but after 9/11, it was a big impact on me because I was on the bus going into the city, right on the Hudson River, with a full view of the towers. And my bus was one of the last. We had a full view of what happened. It was really a strong emotional thing. And our bus was in the last ones that went into the city, and then we were trapped in there. We couldn't get home. I couldn't get home for almost 18 hours. And yeah, it was a pretty strong thing. And then shortly after that, I had a death in the family. My brother died, and I started to really reassess my personal values and life goals and that sort of thing. And it's funny, you know, just as your idea of what you think you want to do with the rest of your life, and when I was young and wanted to be in the city, just as that changed, it changed again, you know, really, that I really didn't want to have anything to do with going to work in New York and a lot of the superficial things that meant, which I was in the advertising industry, you know, and it's not the most honorable industry in the world. It's not bad. I met a lot of really good people, but, you know, they're selling things a lot of people don't need, trying to convince people that they need things they don't, and spend more money on something than they should.
It's a pretty tough industry, isn't it?
It's very competitive, it changed a lot, and it just didn't interest me anymore. I mean, I liked the people I met there. I worked with all young people. I mean, it was in my 30s, and all of my colleagues and were in their 30s, and it was fun. I met really nice, good, smart people that I enjoyed being around. But I just didn't have any interest in it. And this dog sled thing, I grew up in a family that owned a small local free magazine, kind of like a Penny Saver, but it had news in it. And that's where I learned photography. My dad one day said, "Oh, our darkroom guy didn't come in. Do you want to do that? And I was into cars and stuff as a 16, 17-year-old. I didn't really see myself as, you know, the kid going around high school with the photographer hang. You know, those were the art guys.
Art school kids.
But so I ended up in the dark room and just fell in love with it. And then I ended up being one of those art school dudes. But so I learned the trade of newspaper, and this was back in the late 70s. I learned, like, old school newspaper business. And my dad was very entrepreneurial. Instead of paying somebody to print his newspaper, he bought a used newspaper press from Britain. And I'm not talking about something that's like a copier machine. It was about 60 feet long and had four units with these massive drums and rollers and stuff. And he didn't have three-phase electricity in the garage that he had this, so he hooked up a car engine to power this thing. And he did everything. And so we did everything from get the news, photography, paste up magazine, to print it right there in-house. And so I really learned the business, and it was invaluable, the photography skills I learned there. I used that to get into photography school, and then kind of used that. I guess the point I was trying to make is the skills that I had in advertising and in photography, commercial photography in the city, and then going back to all of the publication skills, kind of dawned on me one day that, you know, I could do something like this, you know, and I could probably do it well, because it was like, for me, combining all the things I've ever done in my life, and it just seemed, wow, I can use a little bit of each of these areas of my expertise to do the magazine. And so I had had the idea floating around for a couple of years. I wasn't really happy with my reason for starting a sled dog magazine was I wasn't really happy with the way it was being done. I really thought it stunk. I know the people who published both of the American publications, and they were passionate about what they did, but I really thought I could do a lot better. I thought the sport deserved a lot better, and I thought the fans of the sport deserved a lot better. I was tired of the sport being portrayed as, like, you know, some sort of parlor act and some sort of circus novelty. You know, the people who I'd met in the sport, from the distance people to the serious sprint people, were serious athletes and treated their sport as seriously as a lot of major, major sports people who were getting paid a lot more money, you know. So I wanted to show it as a serious sport. I wanted to show the dedication it took to to be involved in the sport and the commitment and the passion people have for it. So I tried to buy one of the publications, one of the older publications, and that kind of fell through. And I thought, well, and I was just going to leave it at that. And I thought, you know, I have all these great ideas. Let me just try and start something from scratch. So I did, and that was Sled Dog Sports Magazine, and that was in the summer of 2004. It came out in fall of 2004, and I didn't really know what I was doing. You know, I knew the first few issues. I look back at them now, and sometimes I have to kind of just not look at them because I've made so many mistakes. But it was a learning experience, and I think even though there were, you know, mistakes, there were typography mistakes, there were spelling and grammar mistakes in the editing of the articles, I think the one thing that did show through was the passion and the ideas for the sport. And they looked good, and that was the one thing I could do. I could make them look pretty good with the skills that I had. So I think people latched onto it, and it really went very successful. I thought it was successful. We were up to, I think, like 2,000 subscribers by the time I merged it with Mushing Magazine. So anyway, the Sled Dog Sports turned out pretty cool, and the owners of Mushing Magazine, which was the only American color magazine other than mine, got in touch with me. They'd been doing it. They started it in 1988, and they were kind of tired. Their kids had graduated from high school and stuff, and they didn't want to do it anymore. And they really weren't mushers, so I think it was hard for them to muster the enthusiasm to do the magazine and really stay up to date. So it just kind of seemed natural, and I purchased that publication and merged Sled Dog Sports and Mushing into one. My idea was originally to keep them separate, to keep Sled Dog Sports as the kind of hardcore racing publication, you know, and then Mushing Magazine be the general interest publication. But I soon realized that the sport is not big enough to support that.
Okay.
I hope someday that it will be, but some people may beg to differ. But I think I've done a good job of creating a magazine that has a little bit for everyone. I mean, if you're a hardcore racer, you might not read a third of the magazine. If you're just a recreationalist, there might be a third of the magazine that doesn't pertain to you. But I try to show all of those other areas in lights that might, or in ways that to make them interesting to other people. And the big thing I want to do with Mushing now is try and make, without losing the focus it has on the kind of the inside of the sport, try to make it appealing to the general public. And the ways we're trying to do that is through, stop me if I'm rambling on, but the ways I'm trying to do that is to show the personal side of mushing and the experiences in mushing. And Amanda Bird, who is in Fairbanks, is a great editor, and her and I sit down and we really rack our brains and talk to people and try to find people to write for each issue who are out there doing some pretty amazing things with their dog teams. And I think, you know, you read about a guy who lives in the Arctic in the Brooks Range with his 22 Malamutes for 4 months of the year. And you really don't have to be a dog musher to appreciate that. You can be, you know, if you've ever seen snow, you'll appreciate how hard that is. So we wanted to appeal to, you know, the guy who has, or the family who has a Samoyed and they're sitting in their living room in Seattle or, you know, New Jersey or New York or Ohio, anywhere, and kind of just imagine, you know, themselves in this situation or, you know, we're hoping to open it up to a broader public, and I think that's going to be key in having the magazine grow.
Well, and your passion obviously shows through, especially listening to you. That's just amazing stories. Now, how did you manage all this when you were living in Jersey up until recently? Did you fly back and forth quite a bit, or?
Yeah, well, I didn't fly. I flew a few times to Alaska, but I raced here. I spent 3-4 months of the winter with my dogs racing around Alaska, and on the way to Alaska, I would race in Canada and across the United States. So I spent a large time of the year on the road, but you know, I don't think I could have done it 15 years ago or even maybe even 10 years ago, but the advent of desktop publishing has really helped a lot. And the internet to be able to stay in touch has been really tremendous. I mean, you can be anywhere. I mean, I could be sitting in a hotel room in Barbados and publish Mushing Magazine because I can stay in touch with people. I mean, I've come up here and I know the people, so I know who to contact and know how to stay in touch with them. You know, but having said that, being on the ground in Alaska, going to races, is the best way to really keep your thumb on the pulse of what's going on. But really, it's not that hard to learn about anything in the world now and become almost an expert on it, you know, because of the internet, because of information sharing. So it really wasn't hard to do. I moved to Alaska because I wanted to live in Alaska myself.
Right.
I when I came here, the first few times I came and visited to watch races, and then eventually came to race. But really, I admired about Alaska is the people here. You know, Alaska is not a place you just drive through and stop. You know, it's the people who are here. To me, and maybe these were just the people I met, they were people who wanted to be here. They'd made conscious decisions that this is how I want to live my life. You know, back in Jersey and New York, it was like, oh, everyone is whining, everyone's complaining, you know, I'm not doing what I want to do, blah, 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 blah. I didn't get that a lot from people up here, and I kind of like that. I was tired of all the whining back east.
Do you feel like you're living the American dream? Is this like, I mean, this
I don't know. I'm living my dream, but I'm not, you know, I'm never content. I've got a lot of ideas for other magazines I'm going to start, and I'm not the kind of guy that can move up here and be a hobbit, you know? So when we chose a place where we could have dogs, but yet wasn't so far into the wilderness that we didn't have electricity and DSL and that sort of thing.
I was going to ask you about that internet site. It's like, what in the world were you doing up there without internet?
It was actually, you know, one of our main things. Every house we looked at, we inquired about the DSL, because I've used satellite for computers, and it's kind of slow. And doing the magazine, it's just imperative that you have high speed. You have some bandwidth to be able to move things around. Otherwise, it would take a million times as long.
So when you published that first publication of the Sled Dog Sports, did you quit your job? Or how long was it before this magazine was your job?
Oh, a long time, actually. And it still really isn't. I do a lot of freelance graphic design work. I guess I started in the summer of 2004. I was still representing photographers in the city, going in 3 days a week for another year. Then I stopped doing that, but I did other freelance graphic design work. The magazine is really a passion. It's not a living. I wouldn't recommend doing a print publication for anyone who wants to get rich nowadays, you know.
So we're not going to get rich on this podcast thing?
No, well, I said print publication. You never know.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, audio is the way.
we don't think so either.
We're just teasing.
You get out of anything what you put into it. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, why don't you just start a website? But my experience had been in print, and I think websites are great for a lot of things, but there's an experiential difference between reading a print publication and looking at something on the internet. And, you know, I won't go into the pros and cons unless you guys are interested. But
just from a consumer side, I mean, I don't think there's anything more than we look forward to is grabbing, you know, we'll fight over it. As soon as the magazine comes, you're right. It's the whole ability to snuggle up and read it where you want to read it, not sitting down in front of your computer, wherever that is, or even on a laptop, but just to touch and feel and go slow and go fast and skip ahead and go back. And, you know, the magazine print media is just a wonderful, wonderful imagery and a wonderful experience. So,
well, I've designed a lot for the web and for print, and it's always a joy to design in print because you have, I mean, not so much with the magazine, but you have different papers you can use when you're designing things like annual reports and stuff. But, you know, you can really create an atmosphere a lot better when you're designing a print publication than you can on the web. You know, you can put words and pictures together in ways that just create a more personality, or you, at least you can control the personality that it does convey a lot more in print, and I kind of like that. Yeah, I want people to, you know, if anything, you know, I want people to pick up the magazine or anticipate getting the magazine, be passionate about it, and, you know, and be as passionate about it as we are about putting it out. I mean, we really have a lot of fun doing it, and I don't think that, you know, if it was Hardware Monthly, I don't think I could put the hours in on it that I can do on Mushing, you know. I mean, up till 2 or 3 in the morning when we have deadlines and, you know, designing it and that sort of thing. And it's a lot of fun to do.
Now, how about a favorite article over the whole time? You got anything that
I would have to say, my favorite, we publish a lot of great articles. I really like the stuff about the adventure articles, like this guy, one of our writers, Ron Kazaya. He goes out with, he's not a racer, he's a school teacher, he lived in the bush in Alaska, but he has a recreational team, he now lives in Fairbanks, and he just goes, when he has his 2 weeks off in the middle of the winter, he just takes his dog team, puts them in the truck, they're trained, of course, you know, he trains around Fairbanks, and he just goes out into the wilderness, And sometimes he hunts caribou. Sometimes he's just going out to explore the Denali Range. That to me is like, you know, that's modern day. Yeah, that's really living life. You know, these aren't experiences people are getting in front of a video screen playing video games, you know. And that's another thing I want to, you know, I really like the junior aspect of this. And when I was the vice president of the New England Sled Dog Club for a couple of years, the best time of that whole thing was doing the junior program there. I think it's really neat to get juniors into this, get them outdoors, have them have real experiences rather than sitting in front of, you know, a video console shooting policemen. You know,
it's exactly
a reference to violent video games. But, you know, I think that's really neat. And those are some of my favorite stories, to get back to your question. But I think all in all, the first interview I did when I first started Sled Dog Sports, I interviewed Terry Streeper. That first interview was, I was really hyped up for it. And I know Terry was, because I had bounced the idea off of him quite a bit. You know, I thought, well, God, what am I going to say for 20 minutes? But we actually spoke on the phone for like 3 hours. And that was probably, I think that was probably my favorite. I don't know if it was the best one we've ever done, but it was definitely my favorite, and probably a lot of it because it was the first one I did. But we've got some great stuff coming up too.
Have you seen any surprises or anything that you'd say, wow, this one just totally surprised me when I did this or went here or interviewed this person?
I don't know. I don't know if I'd be surprised by a lot of stuff.
No, that's a good point.
Well, you know, coming from Manhattan.
Going back, well, you know, it's the extreme that surprises me. Seeing these guys who do these adventures, like this guy Joe Henderson, who goes and he every winter he retraces part of Ernest DeCoven Leffingwell, who was a famous explorer, or not as famous as he should have been, explorer. He retraces part of his route by dog sled, and he has 22 Malamutes, which, you know, if you've ever gone to a Malamute dog show or even seen some of them at dog sled races, they're not the easiest dogs to control. I mean, I started with purebred dogs, I know. He runs them in a fan hitch, and they all, you know, interact together, and he's out there braving the cold, you know, not seeing someone for 3 months or whatever. That is pretty, I get a lot of credence to that, and just really, I admire that a lot. Yeah.
What do you think is going in their head to say, hey, you know, I think I'll spend the next 3 months. I don't know. I just, that is so far beyond what I think I'm capable of. It's just amazing.
Me too. I don't know. I think, you know, people are drawn to different things, and I could certainly relate to being drawn to solitude. I don't think Joe's doing it for the money. I think he loves getting out there. There's, my opinion on that is the simpler and more focused you get on one thing, it's almost like a meditation or a zen. I'm sure when he goes out there and his day-to-day concerns are, how am I going to get firewood? Every picture of his sled has stacks of driftwood and blown down trees, because I'm sure he collects every bit of wood he can. He's above, you know, timberline, and there's no trees around or very little. So he's got to start a fire every night. And when your concerns are, how am I going to, you know, am I going to be able to get the cooker going in this windstorm? Or how am I going to keep the dogs warm? It's 40 below and it's snowing. Or how am I going to get across that glacier, because there might be crevasses in there? When you're concerned about stuff like that, I think it puts a focus in your life, you know, in your mind, that really grounds you. You're not worried about a lot of frivolous things at that point. And, you know, it's like really focusing on something. It can clear your head sometimes. And I think it probably does that for him, like a marathon runner or anyone who does that. It becomes, it becomes something that they use as a form of clearing their heads and, you know, getting to know themselves and, you know, kind of a meditation thing, I guess.
A very long, long marathon. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Hey, you said a couple of seconds ago that you've got some exciting things happening in the future with mushing as far as some articles and different things. What did you mean by that?
Well, one of the few things I'm pretty excited about is we've introduced in the last couple of issues stories that have nothing to do with mushing, but I thought would interest mushers. Mushers are a really diverse group, but we've introduced a column called Other Lives and another one called Alaska Stories. And these are basically stories that come up. They're not about mushing. One is about the other lives that mushers have, because we're such a varied group, you know, very diverse. You can have doctors and lawyers, and you can have, you know, what people probably think mushers should be, you know, people living in the woods at kind of almost a subsistence type living. Right. And a lot of these people do different things, like I did when I was starting out. And I think that's interesting to people. And I think that's also interesting to people who are fans of the sport and people who aren't mushers, which is always in the back of our minds to try to make the magazine appealing to. The other is this Alaska stories thing. We find great stories that really have nothing to do with mushing, but just are very humorous. One was of the last one, the September-October issue, was called about cabin dwelling in Fairbanks. There's this whole subculture of kids who go up there for college that don't live on campus. They live in these dry cabins with no running water. You know, they might be from Virginia or Ohio or wherever, and they get thrown into, you know, 50 below Fairbanks in the winter, and they have a cabin with no running water. And it was a very, very humorous account on how about that. And the one before that was a writer that I really like. He wrote about just about hanging out with the outdoor recreation crowd in Fairbanks, and there were a couple of sled dogs in the backyard, and he was having a barbecue, and he just basically told a story about that. And these things aren't really mushing related, but I really enjoy publishing that. I think they're funny. I think they're entertaining, and that's part of the magazine I really like.
You know, and I think between the magazine and listening to Dee Dee and Martin's interview and so forth, you know, that is such a part of it. It's people, what they, I don't want to say what they have to do, but what they do in order to be able to mush. You know, it's the things that are behind the scene, whether they're, you know, fishing all summer or a guide or, you know, working in industry or a doctor or whoever, to do what they can do so that they can afford and supply what they need for to mush. So it's just kind of an interesting.
Yeah, I mean, the sport is one of the most, even at a hobbyist recreational level, I would challenge anybody to find a sport that is more time-consuming, requires more of a commitment than the sport, because you need to sacrifice a lot to have dogs.
Yeah.
And you have, and a lot of it is, you know, you've got to make up for it on the other end somehow. Yeah, yeah. Some people do some pretty crazy things to be able to mush over the winter.
Well, and it's not always money. You know, we look at it in the sprint world and you say, gosh, the money is important. But yeah, I think you just summed it up. It's the time commitment. I can't imagine almost any other sport that requires, you know, an hour or two a day to go out and work on your snowmobile or your, you know, or your
365
your,
days
yeah,
a year.
Yeah, 365 to work on your car or your truck or whatever your sport.
Yeah.
It's definitely interesting.
Saying if you were a skier, you know, you put your skis in the closet over the summer. If you're a cyclist, the bicycle's in the garage over the winter. You just can't do that with a yard of dogs or even just a few dogs.
Exactly.
You know, it affects every decision you make on how long you're going to go away for vacation, you know, whether you can stay over someone's house at night because
right.
you have to get home to feed dogs. It requires
Absolutely.
A huge commitment.
Well, what would you like to tell everybody about mushing that maybe we haven't talked about so far?
I think the magazine pretty much speaks for itself. We're trying to do the best we can without a lot of huge national advertising. I think, you know, sometimes people call and say, well, you know, we called yesterday and we didn't get a response, you know, but we're not Time Warner. You know, we're Mushing Magazine. It's basically myself and my editor in Fairbanks. And I do everything from, I've tried hiring bookkeepers and hiring people to manage the subscription database, but it just is better because we're so small to do it ourselves. We have 5,000 subscribers, and that's growing, and I'm really happy about that. And we went to all color a couple of issues ago, and that's really been a boost to our newsstand distribution. A lot more distributors have been willing to carry us being all color, but that really cost us a lot more money to print each issue that way. The cost of paper is just astronomical. Mushing kind of speaks for itself. We're trying to do the best we can, cover the sport in the most professional way, and convey the passion, you know, for dog sledding that we have. We want, you know, it's exciting when you step on the back of a dog sled, and there's no way a video, a movie, a print publication, a website can totally convey that feeling you get. We want to try and come as close as possible as we can to giving people that feeling.
That's awesome. Now, do you print at all? Do you've got the big 60-foot printer out in the garage?
No. That's the one thing I don't do, you know, in this day and age. I can't, because color printing is just something different. It's actually printed in the lower 48, and our mailing house is at the print shop, so it all gets printed and mailed from down there.
That's wonderful.
That's the one thing we don't, that's probably the only thing we don't do, really.
So all the writers for the magazine, other than yourselves and so forth, that's all freelance and or people just supplying articles to you?
Exactly, yeah. The way the magazine used to be produced, to the best of my knowledge, before I took it on, was that people would submit articles, and then the editorial staff with the former publishers would sit down and kind of narrow those down. But we weren't happy with the articles that were coming in. We took a more proactive way to do it, and that was to go out and say, well, we want this subject in each magazine. We have a kind of a hit list of about 10 subjects that we try to get in each magazine. You know, history, adventure, pure breed, news, racing, all these things, juniors, we try to get in each issue. And then we sit down and we talk about, my editor and I, we actually don't sit down, we usually talk over the phone. And we have a creative meeting and we say we assign those stories to people that we know are going to do a good job, that we know a lot about the area that we're asking them to write about. And over the years, we've really refined it. We've got some great writers. I mean, we've got John Little, Joe Runyon, Miriam Corner in Saskatchewan, and these adventure guys, Joe Henderson, Ron Kazaya, Brent Sass, and his friend, his photographer, Ken Tate, go on these adventures all the time. And these are all mushers. Everyone who writes for us is a musher or a veterinarian slash musher. I mean, 99%. Yeah. And I think that's important because we want to be an authoritative voice. Not that how to do something, but we want to walk the walk and talk the talk.
Well, Greg, this has been fantastic. I want to say thank you for everything you're doing for all of us out here that are reading, but also please, if you get a chance, let Amanda know how much we appreciate her as the editor, and obviously give your wife a big hug for us for letting you move to Alaska, I think.
Yeah.
How is she doing up there? Is she liking it?
She loves it. You know, it isn't just my dream to come up here. It was a big dream for her too, to get out of the urban environment and kind of live a little quieter, simpler lifestyle. So far, it hasn't been simpler, but we hope it will.
Been quieter?
Yeah, a little bit. Although we moved into a great neighborhood. Everyone has come by, like all the neighborhood people have come by and introduced themselves and brought over jam and homemade bread and stuff. I guess it was a good year for berries up on Hatcher Pass because we have a refrigerator full of homemade jam now.
That's awesome.
From all the neighbors who've stopped in, and I appreciate every jar. It's great.
You say that,
we just got a jam today
ourselves even. It's funny. Somebody dropped one off to us too. It must have been a good year for berries everywhere.
All around. Yeah, that's funny. The one thing I have found is that I know, you know, most of my friends are mushers, and I know a lot of people in the mushing community. We're very opinionated. But the thing that has surprised me is I don't get a lot of opinionated letters to the editor. And I was really surprised about that. I thought there'd be so many for each issue that, you know, I wouldn't be able to fit them all in. I'm surprised at how many people actually do write in, good or bad. You know,
most
people say, well, why didn't you do this? Or I don't agree with what you said. I would love that, but we don't, that's one thing that has surprised me a little bit, going back to your earlier question. I'm surprised at how little feedback we get. And I talked to some other publishers, and they said, man, don't sweat that, you're lucky. Because 90% of the mail that comes into a publication is usually like, boy, you guys really screwed this subject up or that or that. We don't get a lot either way.
Mushers don't have time.
Well,
I guess, yeah.
We were surprised, too. I mean, we don't have that many podcasts out there yet, but we did not get comments until, like, a couple weeks ago.
We
thought something was wrong with our server. You know, we're thinking, tell us, like, you like it or you hate it, or just tell us you're out there, because we knew they were hitting. And we can...
But we don't get. I don't know. It's a strange phenomenon. I don't know why.
Well, part of it, I think, is that, you know, I think we all, almost everybody's grown up in this sport. And when you go to a race, and 90% of the people you see at a race working at the race, if not more, are volunteers, you know, you don't give a lot of feedback of saying, gosh, they should do this better and they should do this. You know what? These people are giving their all for the sport and for the dogs and for the race. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't give negative feedback to volunteers. And I think a lot of us, like you said, everybody's opinionated. If you get them in a, you know, you put them in a pub or a coffee house and you ask some questions, boy, they'll give it to you. But I don't think they're going to reach out and spank anybody like you would if, you know, in Detroit or, you know, New York or somewhere else where you don't have anything else to do. They're just going to pound on you. But it's also, you know, when you want some kind of feedback, it's like, hello.
Yeah, I mean, I take, we've gotten some feedback in the past from time to time. And 90% of it is really positive. Every once in a while, you'll get a letter that someone doesn't agree with something, and you know, I don't dismiss those lightly. I really, you know, this is someone's opinion, and I wish there were more of those, because you learn more from those than, yeah. You know, I know that the information we're putting out there and the interviews and stuff is entertaining and, you know, and of a high quality. So when I get a letter saying, oh, I really enjoyed this or that, but when someone doesn't like something, it really sticks out, and it's like, where did we go wrong there, you know? But I also at the same time know you can't please everybody, and I don't want to make, and I don't think any publication benefits from going the middle of the road, plain vanilla route either, where right. Everyone just is so happy that, you know, there's no personality to it. So yeah, not that we're going to be real edgy, but, you know, we put in what we want to put in, what we think is pertinent. I got more letters saying, hey, you know, you did that story, but you didn't touch on this, or, you know, you maybe should have put more emphasis on that. But that's
just me. Are you having to cut back your articles a lot, you know, for space and that kind of stuff where you might have, you know, like in your past life?
Yeah, well, you know, with every publication, to actually be profitable or be in the black, you have a certain amount of ad pages, a certain percentage of your publication that should be advertising. And we're way below what we should be at. I think we have 10 pages of advertising in a 64-page publication. And if you look at, you know, like real magazines like Outside Magazine, or they're up around 25%, 30%, or even higher advertising.
Don't be a Vogue or whatever, which is like, 90% yeah. advertising and 10%?
Yeah. I don't think we'll have the pull-out scent things either.
Yeah. But, here's but, what a boots dropping you know, smells like. Yeah,
yeah, that would be funny, yeah. This is what my dog yard smells like. but they, no, you know, we're way below that, but we have to cap it, because in printing, you can't just add a page. You have to add what they call signatures, which is 8 or 16 pages, especially the way our magazine is printed. We're going to keep it either at 48 or 64 pages, which was what we've been at 64 for the last, I don't know, half a year. But by the way, that's almost double what Mushing Magazine was before I combined it with Sled Dog Sports. So there's double the amount of content that there was in each issue.
Wow.
But yeah, there's so much stuff that we commission. We always have articles that are left over that roll over to the next issue, some that we want to publish but sadly can't because we just don't have the space.
Is it a tough call for your price point of how much you can charge for the magazine? And does the price of the magazine at the newsstand or through subscription actually offset a lot of the cost, or is that a drop in the bucket?
No, the cost of printing is much higher than what the subscriptions cost, you know, what they pay for. I mean, it doesn't really equal out that way. The subscription cost is helpful, definitely. Yeah, but that's not a major source of the income. We're higher than, you know, people say, why is it $26 when I can get Sports Illustrated for $7.99 for 12 issues? But they're, you know, they're printing like 20 million of those things.
Yeah,
we have 5,000 subscribers, so it's a little different, you know, the volume wise.
No, I was just gonna say, as soon as Sports Illustrated starts doing a cover to cover on Mushing, then, you know, go ahead and jump over. But until
yeah, right, exactly. You know, and advertisers ask that too. And one of our things is trying to get more national advertisers in. And they're, you know, these guys, they have media buyers that are looking at the spreadsheets, and they're saying, well, you know, your cost per thousand is very high, but the thing that advertisers get with Mushing Magazine is a very, very targeted audience.
Right.
If you're a winter outdoor apparel maker and you put an ad in Outside Magazine, you know, you have, I would say half of the people who read Outside are probably into summer sports and the other half are into winter sports. So you're right there, you're wasting your money, some of your money on an audience that would never buy your product.
Right.
The advantage you have with Mushing Magazine or any niche publication that's as specific as ours is that, you know, your advertising dollars are reaching someone who has the potential to buy your product.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that's one plus we have with advertising. But, you know, our cost the cost for someone to advertise per thousand is probably higher than it is for Outside Magazine, even though their ads, you know, might cost them, you know, $500,000 for a full page ad.
Oh, man. So, well,
ours are only up at 400,000.
Nice. Well, you know, it's funny because our little mush club here called Mid Union Sled Haulers, you know, in the back,
yeah.
Every one of our, you know, I think it's monthly or every other month flyer, whatever it is, you know, they've got an advertise for Mushing Magazine. And I always think to myself,
yeah.
Do you guys pay for a lot of advertising yourselves to get your name out there?
Well, yeah, we do. We do. We actually do a lot. And not all of it. We have a marketing budget I don't want to sound too formal with that, but we spend a lot of money promoting ourselves.
Okay.
And promoting the magazine. And a lot of that is direct mail. You know, that's we found we're able to do well that way. And a lot of it is another big part of it is through clubs, whether it's taking ads out in their newsletter like that with the Mid-Union Sled Haulers on a barter system or outright paying for it, or donating subscriptions to events that they can auction off and help raise money for the club. But we do a lot of that promotion. And we've had ads in Alaska Magazine and places like that. We have ads on during the Iditarod. We buy radio spots on Alaska Public Radio, and we're on, I think, 4 or 5 different public radio stations that do live Iditarod coverage.
Oh wow!
But we are really careful to make sure that we spend money with people who are doing the sport a service. You know.
Yeah.
And I do that with my personal dollars too. You know, we moved up here and we had to buy a lot of winter clothing. And I didn't buy it from REI or EMS or L.L. Bean. I bought it from the companies that support the sport, like Cabela's and Apocalypse Design and Fairbanks. And I think that's one thing people can do to help. Everyone asks, well, you know, why isn't the sport, you know, more in the mainstream? What can I do to support it? And that's one of the things you can do. Spend your money with people who are with businesses that are really helping the sport.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what we're trying to do too. You know, we're between... Yeah. Just, you know, Dr. Tim Hunt, you know, trying to support, you know, just throw everything back to the folks here. You know, you can give your food to a lot of, you know, big groups, but
Walmart or whatever, but
you know, Red Park, why don't you give it to Eagle Pack, somebody that is definitely all behind the sport. So,
Yeah. I think that's an important thing to do. Definitely.
Well, Greg, this has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah. And you guys are doing a great job with your podcast. Glad to see another venue out there for people to learn about the sport.
Wow. Thank you so much, Greg. Hilarious stories, isn't it?
Oh, it was great. Absolutely great. What I think I liked most about his interview was, again, just seeing how God had prepared Greg in his early life by having his dad make a magazine in his garage or wherever their basement, and how all that just took place in his adult life. I mean, we see that so often, how things that we do now are really the things that we were prepared to do as children. And I just thought that was really cool.
It was neat
layout altogether.
You know, with everybody's different stories, you know, with Martin careening over the edge, you know, in Martin's interview, I think just a picture, you just get such a vivid image of Greg pulling up with his truck in front of the brownstone, New Jersey, and having people, you know, beep as he's double parked and he's running through the house to get the dogs from the backyard to drag him through the house,
right,
only to put him in the box and then drive away. But it's just hilarious.
Right.
I just can't imagine
It's quite a dedication, I tell you. I don't know that I could do it. Even the dogs in Manhattan.
Exactly. Don't forget to go, and if you're not a subscriber to Mushing Magazine, definitely get it. Go out to mushingmagazine.com and make sure you get a copy of the magazine and or subscribe. Fantastic work, and obviously you heard with Greg the dedication and passion.
You can actually get that link right from our site.
Yep.
If you don't
right
have the subscription, just get it right from our site.
Yep, so it's nice to go there also. So we've got another tip from Dr. Tim coming up.
Yeah, let's listen to that.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Fantastic. So, Dr. Tim, why don't you talk to us about how to train a lead dog?
Sure. You know, I think the best way to train a lead dog is to buy someone else's old, experienced lead dog and bring it into your team, and then run dogs next to it and let them teach that dog how to do it right. Now, traits can be trained into the other dogs, both good and bad, and I've had that happen with my dogs where they've taught them really good things and other dogs where they've taught them how to pee on trees. So we want to have a sled dog that's been experienced. I think that's going to really streamline things, especially if you're new to the sport, where you can have someone experienced up there that's going to do a lot of work for you instead of you guessing what to do. So when we got this experienced lead dog up front, then I just try to find a dog that seems to be really driven to go, and then I take time of putting that dog up with that other experienced lead dog, and I almost always will do it when I'm coming home. So I think with new lead dogs, where you're trying to bring them into the fray, I look for dogs in the team that are seemingly more driven than the rest and maybe a little bit smarter, so to speak, but not always, just more driven. And then I'll take them out on a run, and I only introduce dogs to the lead when I'm coming home because they know there's an end point and they're familiar with the trail. So an out-and-back trail, they're with an experienced lead dog. Then I'll put that new dog that's never been up front up in front to try it out that way. I like to try lead dogs up in the team versus doing anything one-on-one. It's worked for me. The other thing I'll tend to do with these dogs, if I'm not having one dog that's really jumping out at me, is I tend to cycle dogs in the swing quite a bit, and that's the position behind lead. And I look to see how they like the pressure of being close to the front. And if I'm still unsure on dogs and I put them up into swing and they're showing that they've got the gusto to go up forward, then I'll put them up into the front versus trying to take one from the back. So I kind of wean them to the front, get them into swing, see how they handle the pressure of being close to the front, and then I put them up in the front. And I often will do that, almost always, initially on the way home. I tend to work them up in the front maybe one out of every three runs when I'm trying to bring a lead dog into the fray. And then once they seem like they've got it together enough, I'll start to put them in lead on the way out of the yard, but never when I'm hooking up in the yard. It's just too much pressure on these dogs to actually stand there and hold the team in place when they're young. I think you're just apt to make more mistakes that way. So, again, I'm trying to bank on success. What's going to make this dog happy and be up front? Running home, number one, because they're running to their dog yard, they're going to be fed. Then number two, familiarity with the trail. So after I have them running home, I actually start to put them in the lead maybe halfway out of the yard, okay, like a mile or two out of the yard or three. And then later on, once maybe done 10 or 12 runs like that, then I might actually look at putting them into lead from the yard themselves versus right off the bat. I think there's just too many things that can go wrong when you start right out of the yard with a young, untested dog up in the front. So we want to bank on success as to what I'm going to plan here to make this successful for that lead dog, because it is a tough spot to be in. And once you blow a lead dog up front, meaning something happens that really scares them, terrorizes them, you lose your team or whatever, it's very difficult to bring those dogs back into wanting to be up in the front. And it takes an exceptional dog to get through an early trauma like that to actually be successful again up front. So I want to avoid anything that could make a mistake happen with that lead dog up there that's just getting into the mix. So I want to plan my route out, plan where I'm going to put him into lead, plan how long I'm going to run him. And then also, if we have a dog up front and he's not really digging it, I mean, he's looking back a lot and he's not doing it, you know, take him out. Bring him out of the dog team. Put him back in the team. And I've had dogs that have become exceptional leaders when they've been 5 years of age. But I usually work with these dogs maybe when they're two, and I bring them into that mix like I was talking about, because I think they've had enough battle-testedness to actually get through some of the excitement of being in a dog team and getting through, you know, passing cars and seeing other loose dogs and such. But being up front is a special place, and we just want to slowly build them into that spot. The last thing I guess I would consider with lead dogs, you know, does it make a difference with a boy or girl? Heck no. I like running girls in heat. I think it brings the whole team along, but you have to have a good dog team to do that with. I think the biggest thing people do is they yak too much when they're on the sled. They just talk too much. And if you minimize what you're saying to the dogs, use your time in the dog yard when you're feeding to teach them tones, when you're giving them food. Use those tones when you're on the sled and use them sparingly. They'll tend to listen. If you're talking to them in sentences, they only hear blah, blah, blah. If you use just words and those words that you might use in a dog yard, then that can carry over to trying to train that young leader into making a bona fide leader, and then calming the whole team down for that matter. You can calm a team down on the side of a cliff by using tones that you use in a dog yard, even though it's scary as heck and very difficult for these leaders, but you get them through it because they trust you, because you started that in the dog yard, and it just carries through the team. So I hope that made sense, because I really think the dog yard is a huge place to instill trust in your dogs, and then it carries over when you're on the sled. Just don't talk so much.
Dr. Tim, you mentioned a two-year-old going into lead. We've got a couple one-year-olds that we're considering for lead this season. So should we keep them in swing this season and wait until next season?
Nope, I'd start them off in the team, rotate them around in the team, see how they do in swing. Get them into condition first, okay? Early in the season right now, they're not in condition, so physically they're not going to have it together. First get them into shape, and then that one-year-old I'd run in swing in different positions until about November, and then I might start to plop them up in the front when you're coming home. So when you're looking at something psychological with the dogs, I want the dogs in shape first, physically. Okay, so that's going to take a couple of months to get them into shape, so I use my experienced leaders up front most of the time. Then once they get into shape and their muscles are ready and everything, then I'll start to experiment with their head. Because if they're not physically in shape, it can mess up your psychological training of the dog just because they get tired. Okay, so what I would do with that young dog is get them through, part of this year, try them up and lead in November or so, on the way home and see how he responds to it. And, you know, encourage him when you're going. But, you know, dogs are encouraged by really four things, food, praise, touch, and sex. And when you're on the sled behind them, you can't do number four. That doesn't work so well. But you can talk to them. But you have to time it correctly. So you want to build for success. Do it when they're physically sound. Use your tones like we talked about. But time your tones for when they do the correct thing and then leave it at that. Don't talk when they do the wrong thing. I really think if you ignore the bad habits or the habits you do not want in your lead dogs, they go away, okay? Versus telling them, no, that's not what I want. Just ignore it and then only say something when they do it right. They learn they hear dad's voice when they do this. Versus they hear dad's voice when I do a little bit of everything, okay? Mm. And with a young dog, I think that's key, like a one-year-old. So I'm not opposed to trying that. I think you just need to plan out for how is this going to be most successful. Get them in shape, and then go from there on the way home with your runs.
And I just have one more on that, those yeah. one-year-olds. One of the two is extremely fast. I free run them through the woods, and they come to me on command, and they're pretty well trained. But one is exceptionally fast. Does that mean she's going to – is that a sign of a good leader?
No, not necessarily. I think that's a sign of an athletic dog, which is going to put her up on the scale of watching what we do. But I think we can pin a lot of false hope on these really fast dogs when they're free running, and then we have too much of an expectation on them over the rest of the dogs. To me, you know, I put it in my back in my locker there in my brain that this dog was the fastest of the puppies and probably the most athletic dog of the bunch. But now we've got to see if we can mold her brain to work, okay, into what we want to have happen. So I wouldn't necessarily pick her over the others. I would cycle her through the rotation up front, and then give them all chances to run lead to see how they handle it, but just do it slowly, knowing that she's the most athletic one, but they don't always turn out to be the best dog, okay? But it would be nice if she did, because that's how good teams really become good, is they have 10 of those dogs like that, and they know how to train their minds into working as a unit.
That's great. And Dr. Tim, how about agility courses or polls to go through to learn commands and that type of thing? Do people still do that?
I think some people do that, not very often. You know, working one-on-one, can't remember the guy's name that wrote the book about it back in the 70s, Levon Barve, he wrote a book about working one-on-one with these dogs, teaching them those kind of commands as well. I think Jamie Nelson does that as well, teaching them with just a leash on one-on-one type training. I just don't have enough time to do that. I think there's a place for it. You just have to figure out how to, you know, make that kind of a training happen successfully. So they learn that what you're telling them is going to stick in their brain. But no, I don't see anything wrong with it. You just need to map out your training before you go out in the woods with a dog on a leash. Plan what you're doing before you get out there and wonder, what am I doing? Because that just leads to mistakes.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Wow, thank you so much, Dr. Tim. And thank you, Greg, for the interview and for everybody for listening.
Another great episode, Tim.
Don't forget to go out to the Amazon link and use that Amazon link and also give us some feedback if you like the show.
Yeah, any of the interviews that you've listened to, underneath it, there's a comment section right on the website, if you're actually listening from the website, I guess. So if you do come to the website, feel free to leave us a comment. We'd love that.
And ideas. If you've got somebody that you'd like us to interview or go after to try to interview, let us know. Or if you want to do some interviews yourself and want to send them to us, maybe we can put them up on the podcast.
Yeah,
so it'd be fun
great.
Too. And don't forget to go to www.sleddogpodcast and do something there, I guess.
How about listen to the podcast?
That's it. Give us
Leave us
feedback.
A comment, go to Amazon, and you know what? Be blessed, everyone.
Take care.